Good evening.
Good evening.
Very nice to see you. It's visiting Santa Cruz Center. Again, this introduction. Thikkhun Kelly speaking book on the Heart Sutra is going to be published in a week or so. But some books are here already. So I'd like to do some reading from this book. It has a kind of very pretentious subtitle, A Comprehensive Guide to the Classics of Mahayana Buddhism. And I'm not sure if it's right to say the classic of Mahayana Buddhism. Certainly one of the important texts, probably most frequently, most widely recited scriptures in Mahayana Buddhism. And we all know that no eyes, no ears. And I think it's very perplexing, enigmatic text. We have no idea why we chant every day, no eyes, no ears. And then some of us are maybe reading that text and said, no eyes, no ears. So it's a kind of challenge. And then I think it's accurate to say that we don't understand it. We have no idea what it is talking about. And I think the reason why it is so difficult is because the Heart Sutra describe the state of meditation, not just an usual intellectual kind of world views, but I think, you know, in a way, during meditation we experience all levels of consciousness. Often we have pains, we're sleepy and we have some problems. So that's kind of most shallow kind of self-centered views. But we always experience that. And then we become a little bit freer from that. And then maybe even go deeper. And then in a way the kind of difference between large and small and long and short, right and wrong, even life and death becomes rather obscure and insignificant. So in a way, we experience kind of more selfless state of meditation. And I think maybe in the deepest level, everything is all kind of one, and there is no discrimination, kind of momentary is timeless. Life is death, and death is life. And then you and I, all one mind, one heart, and one world. So that is the kind of the deepest part of our consciousness. Or maybe our existence. And it's not that we only kind of experience shallowness when we are beginning to meditate, and that maybe more seasoned practitioners can only experience the deepest part of our consciousness. Actually, we all experience everything altogether. even the kind of the beginner can experience maybe the deepest part of meditation, according to Zen Master Dogen, kind of remote and humble student of Zen Master Dogen. So, when we are beginning, we don't maybe necessarily notice the kind of deepest part of consciousness. We may not even suspect that there is something like one mind, one world. But when we keep meditating, we start suspecting there must be something like that. And then the Heart Sutra may be addressing this part of our experience. But I think we could make the Heart Sutra a little bit easier for non-Buddhists and Buddhists alike. So we are presenting, we meaning John Halifax Roshi, and I am kind of presenting a new translation of the Heart Sutra, this book. So let me kind of read the first part. And the title we choose is The Sutra of the Heart of Realizing Wisdom Beyond Wisdom. So Prajna is wisdom beyond wisdom. Paramita we translate as realizing. So our intention is that maybe we don't need, there needs to be a translation that doesn't need explanation to even outsiders. You know, because, well, when you say bodhisattva, which is already an English word, but still you need to explain what is, what's the difference between bodhisattva and the Buddha. So we try not to use any technical terms. So we translate everything. Our intention is not trying to replace the chants kind of, commonly recited, but maybe to kind of offer people to have a chance to think about the meanings. Avalokiteshvara, who helps all to awaken, moves in the deep course of realizing wisdom beyond wisdom, sees that all five streams of body, heart, and mind are without boundary and frees all from anguish. O Shariputra, in brackets, who listens to the teachings of the Buddha, form is not separate from boundlessness. Boundless is not separate from form. Form is boundlessness. Boundlessness is form. Feelings, perceptions, inclinations, and discernment are also like this. So you can see almost every word is different. We try to kind of make the Heart Sutra not so negative. And of course the original is negative. In Sanskrit, a means something like asymmetry. A is not. I think there are at least three types of negation. There's pure negation, but also positive negation. You know, when you say there is no question about it, it has a form of negation, but it's positive, right? Or you can say you don't need to do it. It's a kind of a form of negation, but it's a freedom. You have a freedom kind of to do anything you want to do, anything else. So so negation can be in this way positive or kind of an expression of freedom. So we try to see the kind of actual meaning of the Heart Sutra and then sort of put it in a kind of more positive way or, for example, we say, boundlessness is free of the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, free of sounds, free of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and any object of mind. And also maybe skipping one line, and boundlessness is free of old age and death. And free of the end of old age and death. It is free of suffering, rising, cessation, and path. And free of wisdom and attainment. So, seeing the Heart Sutra as a text of freedom. Mm-hmm. And freedom from what? Freedom of self, self-centered idea. Kind of the idea of self as being independent and everlasting. So boundlessness is emptiness is same thing when it is explained. It is empty of independent self and everlasting self. That means freedom from kind of boundary or confinement. And then when we realize that we are not just kind of independent kind of self, we are all connected, and then we become free from anguish. So this is our translation. What is usually translated as emptiness is shunyata in Sanskrit. And shunya actually means zero. So shunyata means zeroness. And of course zero can be empty, there is nothing. But also you can see that zero and one creates binary system. like we, if we look at the computer model, zero and one creates maybe numbers, different numbers, language, even sounds, music, visual images, and even scenes, right? So create movies and so forth. So in a way it's kind of interesting because computer is modeled for maybe some kind of mathematics, but also in a way the whole world maybe, you know, consisting of one and zero. So zero can be very powerful. You can see zero can be everything. So we thought maybe boundlessness would be one potential alternative for emptiness. Let's see. I'm looking for number two. Oh, yeah. In this book, one of the parts is called concepts, terms and concepts. So I'm trying to compare different versions of the Heart Sutra in different languages. So we have maybe three Sanskrit versions. Maybe one is called Horyuji version, transmitted in Japan. And then another is called Amoghavajra version, which was discovered in Donghuan Cave early. So Indian tantric master who kind of wrote it in bilingual ways, Sanskrit and Chinese. He was one of the greatest translators, 8th century, went from India to China, and then Nepalese version. So Sanskrit texts kind of have these three versions, and then we have Chinese version, Shenzong version, and then Amoghavajra version, so maybe two texts, or what I called Alpha version, the earliest known text. So we have three Chinese texts, and then Korean, Japanese, Vietnamese, and then English one. These are all short texts of the Heart Sutra. There are two texts. One is a shorter text, and then the other is a longer text, which has the beginning, thus have I heard, and then end, the Buddha praises Avalokiteshvara and then encourages everyone to practice. So that's a longer version. But the earlier version came first. So I'm going to use, I'm using shorter text, although we have longer text too. And then English one, the oldest translation, Max Müller translation. He was the scholar, German scholar who taught in Oxford, maybe one of the earliest kind of pioneers of Sanskrit and Buddhist studies. And then D.T. Suzuki translation. I think most of the commonly chanted version in English is by Lash, come from D.T. Suzuki translation or Edward Kanze translation, maybe a little bit mixture. And then also our own translation. Tanahashi Halleck's translation. And then I kind of divided the Heart Sutra into 42 segments. So each segment, we have all these versions. And so you can compare kind of different languages, because from Chinese, Shanzong version is the most common. He was a 7th century monk who went to India and then brought a lot of Buddhist texts to China and then created a national project of translating Chinese, translating Sanskrit canon into Chinese. He was a great translator. And because his translation was so accurate, Buddhist studies really flourished in the 7th century and then brought forth the golden age of Buddhism in Tang Dynasty, early Tang Dynasty. So we compare all this. And for example, let's say the title, Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra. Shanzong didn't have this Maha. But anyway, Maha is related to the English word mega. So it's interesting to have comparative studies of Sanskrit word and then English word. It's such a short text, but maybe over 30 kind of words, you can see the kind of linkage, because, you know, in the Indo-European language family is so huge. It includes Indian language, Persian, Slavic, and Latin and Greek and Latin, and then, you know, European languages. So these are all connected. And Julius Focconi, who was an Austrian comparative linguist, he studied many, many languages and many terms, and then made connections, all connections. And, so his comparative studies are by large kind of now kind of common language among comparative Buddhists. So I rely upon his work. If you look at the American Heritage Dictionary, it has connections, especially on the back too, but also you can see. And also there is a dictionary called American Heritage Dictionary of Indo-European Roots. So this has, but this is largely dependent on Focconi's kind of work, which was published in 1960s. So I only use the comparison. I'm not a linguist. So comparison that's been attested by kind of Focconi and then other linguists. So Prajna. Pra is related to English word pro, and it has different meaning, you know, before, but also excellent, like prominent. Junior is related to the English word Gnostic. It's interesting, J and Z are connected, and then Z and K are kind of sisters. So in a way, junior is connected to Gnostic. Now, K is silent in English. So maybe it's connected to know, to know, or knowledge, and so forth. So, Junior. Heart. Prajna Paramita. Heart, you know, whether is related to the English word cardio, like cardiology. And sutra is not in the Sanskrit title. Usually, Indians didn't put the word sutra at the end of the scriptures, like Lotus Sutra or Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra. Chinese just kind of added this word jing, meaning sutra. So when you are actually chanting Mahaprajna Paramita Sutra, these are all Mahaprajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. These are all Sanskrit word. So maybe you have a sense that you are actually reading the title of the sutra, but the original title doesn't have sutra. We only say Prajna Paramita Hridaya. Anyway, sutra is related to the English word sutra, right? Sewing, to sew. So you can see that, it's so interesting to compare the study the Sanskrit, and then, so if you kind of, you read also, you chant in Japanese?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe you can say, okay, shin mu kege, okay, what is mu kege? And then you can kind of check the index and then go there, and then, and then you can find the Sanskrit. So I had so much fun studying. I'm really enjoying this. Everything was discovered. So, we have a kind of a contemporary or modern scholarship. I explained the modern scholarship about the kind of status of studying Sanskrit and then also Chinese and so forth. And then I have a part called Most Recent Scholarship, 1992 up to present. Most. So the reason I say is Dr. Jan Natier, she kind of published a very important article on this in this year, the Heart Sutra column, a Chinese apocryphal text. So the idea, maybe she's kind of, she compared the first, maybe she said so-called Kumarajiva version was not Kumarajiva's, so it was kind of regarded later as Kumarajiva, but Kumarajiva, 4th to 5th century great, maybe greatest translator from Sanskrit into Chinese. So it's not kind of his translation, maybe someone else created. And then she divided the Heart Sutra into three parts. One is Avalokiteshvara part. And then the second part is the main part after Shariputra. And then, all these talking about shunyata, emptiness or boundlessness. And then the mantra at the end. So there are three parts. And then the middle part came from large Prajnaparamita scripture. And then translation by Kumarajiva. So that, and then actually it was known before, already in China. 7th century, it was already known that one, the Heart Sutra, the middle part is kind of exactly kind of, the whole thing was kind of imported from this one small part of the Heart Sutra. One small part of the large Prajnaparamita scripture. And then that became the main part of the Heart Sutra. And amazingly enough, you know, most of the handwritten text of the Mahaprajnaparamita literature have been lost. You know, it was written on the palm leaves, and then you know, in India, by moisture and then insects and everything. Almost everything was lost. However, but almost by accident, this particular part was discovered. You know, was part of the fragments discovered in northern part of present-day Pakistan, called a place called Gilgit. So Gilgit manuscript, you know, 6th century, around that time, it was right there. And she compared that text, the early kind of manuscript, and then the so-called English, Sanskrit kind of version, which is commonly kind of known, of the Heart Sutra. And then she kind of compared the grammar and then terms and so forth. And she said there is a striking similarity between these texts in the meaning. But also there is a striking difference between terms and grammar. So she said the Heart Sutra did not directly come from this Mahaprajnaparamita, directly. There must have been something else, or vice versa. So she developed this idea of back translation. There was a Chinese text was in between. So her theory was that Chinese text was created in China first, and then it was back translated into Sanskrit. Well, back translation means that usually the flow of the text is from kind of India to China, right? Buddhism kind of flow that way. So if you kind of have Chinese text first and then Sanskrit text come later, and then you think maybe this is back translated. And up to now, as far as I know, there are two people who published their opinions about her theory. One is a top Japanese scholar, Dr. Fukui. He said, well, her theory is driven by kind of ideas and theories, and then you cannot prove it. And then the other one was Respond. In his book on the Heart Sutra, he says, we are asked to believe this, but there's no way, you know, we can believe it. Something like that. But I kind of studied it really carefully, and then I kind of completely support her theory, I think. So this book is the first one who gives a kind of thorough examination of Dr. Nachi's theory, and then support it. Mm-hmm. So, 1992 up to 2014. So, Jan Natia says at the end, the Heart Sutra is indeed, in every sense of the word, a Chinese text. Wow. So, and then I examined and then supported her theory. Jan Natia says, somebody has to have back translated that. And then it seems Shan Zong, his great translator, was the one. So her idea is Shan Zong has a Chinese, which we know that when he was studying in western part of China, there was a sick monk he had kind of swelling all over. And he was miserable. And then he helped brought this monk to a temple, and then got clothes and food and so forth. And then in return, this monk showed him the Heart Sutra. So that's recorded by Shan Zong's student. So, and then when he was crossing Gobi Desert, he was kind of surrounded by all the demons. Maybe he was hallucinated. He was so hot and he was thirsty and all that. And then he invoked his guardian deity, Avalokiteshvara, but still his demons are running around. And then finally he chanted Heart Sutra, perhaps a mantra. And then they went away. So we know that he was chanting and then also teaching on his way in Central Asia. He was teaching the Heart Sutra. So Dr. Natia's idea is that maybe Shan Zong kind of retranslated, well, back translated the Heart Sutra from Chinese into Sanskrit. So my question is, would any kind of respected translator would create a text and then translate it into Chinese, creating the so-called original and translate it, and then emperor loved it, and everyone loved it, and it was carved. His translation was carved in the on the stone, right next to the Emperor Tai, the second emperor, introduction to the canon. So the Heart Sutra was given almost the same status as the entire canon, on the same kind of monument, which is an introduction to the canon, by the emperor, and then Shandong's translation of the Heart Sutra. So that kind of became the globalization of the Heart Sutra. It became so important, and then it became so popular. But would any respected translator do such a thing? Now, I'm a translator, I'm kind of sitting on probably the lowest seat of the translators, maybe the newest. But would I do this ever in any kind of circumstances? Create something kind of maybe in another language, and maybe in Japanese, maybe I create a Dogen text and then translate it into English? Never. Never. But it's clear that he was, Shanzong was acknowledged as a translator. So there must have been the original. If there were no translation, no original, there would be no translation. Right? So there must. So how did this translation, the original Sanskrit, appear? So that's my question. And then I realized that there was a text kind of discovered in Dongfang by Stein. Actually, Perry. Stein was a Hungarian archaeologist, but he led the British expedition to Central Asia. Perrier kind of followed a French expedition. There is one text like this. This is, I think, in the Paris National Library. And this is a very interesting text. It says, Sanskrit Prajnaparamita Heart Sutra, translated under the imperial command by Bukong. And then it says, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva had personally taught and bestowed this Sanskrit text to Tripitaka Dharma Master Shanzang. Bukong has edited it. So this is a text. So my kind of question is, and then there was a record. It's not a kind of his students, but maybe later record said when the Emperor Tai, the second emperor of Tang Dynasty, who was a great patron of Shanzong's national project of translating Sanskrit canon into Chinese. He was gravely ill, so he was asked to be with the emperor in a palace outside of Chang'an, the capital city. So he was right there when the emperor was in his deathbed. And then, I think 4 days before the emperor's death, Shanzong translated the text into Chinese. So the idea is maybe he was desperate to have some kind of original Sanskrit version of the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra was often used as a kind of magical text because it has a mantra for healing, or any kind of a version of problems. He really desperately wanted the original Sanskrit text, and when meditators desperately want something, what would they do? They pray to their guardian deities, they meditate, right? And then my idea is that this was Shanson's mystical experience. During meditation, he received it, received the Sanskrit text from Avalokiteshvara. And then, you know, I think most of, if not all, Mahayana texts were like this. They were spoken by the Buddha, but conceived by people, practitioners, during meditation practice. So, all Mahayana texts are in a way mystical texts. And then, so my idea is this was Shanzong's mystical experience. I could say maybe our translation was also received by our lectures. But it's actually, it happened during meditation in Black Forest Monastery in Germany. In one sitting, everything came, except the term boundlessness. I think I'll stop now, and then if you have any thoughts or questions, please. Yes.
Well, I appreciate your working to come up with a way to not say no. And yet I've also been very, to me that's an important part of the Heart Sutra. That was one of the first things that caught my attention before I even really started practice. So I'm curious about your process in working with that. And it seems like you opted on the side of not to say no, just to try to maybe give it a little bit more. I mean, I like it as free from. I think that's very, I think that's accurate. I think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more directly helpful. But did you regret also letting go of the no?
I think, you know, part of the popularity of the Heart Sutra is kind of negation. You feel so good when you deny everything, right? So I regret to have this kind of power of negativity. Yes.
I'm surprised that about you talking about mystical experience with because Buddhism is presented to me often as more of a cumulative tradition rather than revealed tradition. And it sounds like there may be kind of like revealed aspect. And that's kind of part one of my question. And part two is that could this have been a kind of development in China of Buddhist canon, much like how the Madhyamaka was a development of Buddhism and potentially an innovation of Buddhism by Nagarjuna? And could this have been like what's his name? Shenzong? This could have been his contribution in a kind of way. Would that be a way to speak of it or address it?
I think the first question, in a way, I think, you know, you don't put your words into Buddha's mouth, right? You know, I mean, you just kind of, you don't say, okay, this must have been what Buddha said, and then sign your name. Commentaries, yes, you know, treaties. But these were a kind of sutras, all kind of, most of the sutras. I have some we have some exceptions, but Buddha, so maybe can you hear the Buddha saying that. But when you hear that, you have all this background knowledge, and then, you know, maybe social kind of understandings and need. And for example, in India, monks were not allowed to cook, right? Or do labors. But in China, it was cold and kind of communal living, and then people were farming and cooking and cleaning and everything, right? So they needed to have the Buddha kind of teaching how to cook. So this is one example, but there are many kind of social needs. So you kind of, you ask Buddha, what would you say? How do we cook? You know, and so forth. And then, so in a way, you hear these things. People would hear that, and that maybe I would call, you know, emergence of the scriptures. You know, it's not that they created it. Well, in a way, it's they created, and, but it's not like maybe, okay, you have a meeting and say, oh, what shall we do, right, and then how do we do that, and so forth. You kind of, someone kind of maybe perceives it during meditation. Shanzang's, he wanted to go to China, because I started out, you know, about his pilgrimage to the West. And he kind of studied Buddhist philosophy. And then he thought, well, there was not enough kind of materials for yogacara. So, you know, a practice of yoga. That's kind of regarded as the third wheel of the Dharma, you know. The first turning of the Dharma is Buddha's teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and the second is Mahayana, and then the third is Yogacara. In a way, it's a kind of, sometimes it's kind of characterized as consciousness only theory. So maybe that's an important part of Yogacara. So it's not that there is a world and then we conceive it, but that we conceive, therefore there is a world or some phenomena. So it's a kind of 18 degrees, you know, changing. That's kind of happened in German ideology too. Immanuel Kant kind of said that, but you know, because in India it's the 3rd, 4th century, Agansa, Asanga, and Vasvandu. You know. So that was a very most advanced Buddhist theory. And then Shanzong thought there was not enough materials in, you know, accurate kind of materials about this theory. So that's the main maybe motives for him to go to India to look for teaching. So in a way, because his translation, and then he was there in India for 18 years, I think. And he learned Sanskrit, musicology, mathematics, and everything, you know, at the university monastery. And then he became such a good kind of Sanskrit writer. He made a kind of a long treatise trying to synthesize this Nagarjuna's Ajamika, and then Asanga's Yogacara theory. So, and then he was a great debater, and then he kind of, he beat everybody, you know, and then got the support by the king to send him back with kind of relayed escort from India to China. So in a way, Xuanzang was a kind of really a great Sanskritist, and then maybe a theorist. But he didn't, kind of in Chinese, he never wrote commentaries. He only did translations, and then he kind of encouraged his students to write commentaries. So his students kind of started a few schools, and then eventually it became also Tiantai School, one of the major schools. So his influence for kind of for Buddhist studies in China was so great, I think. So I kind of, that's one part is called A Tiny Text by a Giant Translator. But another chapter is called In Print for 1,000 Years. So in a way, interesting, you know, mostly kind of, you might think, you know, Gutenberg was the, you know, the first one who started printing, but actually Heart Sutra is one of the longest kind of text that is in print. Yes?
Our experience with chanting, and then when we try to put language on it, even more so. For you, what's the value of trying to find the most precise words?
Yes, I think trying to is a accurate expression. And I think in a way, you know, every translator has a different kind of, I think everyone tries to make an maybe accurate or precise translation, but everyone has a different idea. What is accurate and what is, like maybe the Dogen text, Soto translation projects, these are all by scholars. So in a way, maybe my guess is their idea is that maybe if you could read the translation and then reconstruct Japanese, maybe that's a kind of accurate translation. To me, it's different. I think we need to deconstruct, you know, to have a kind of really, to carry the poetry and then power of the writings. We have to deconstruct and then find a kind of counterpart in this case, English, that carries this maybe similar meaning and then poetry and the power. So my idea of Dogen translation is maybe if we could give an illusion that Dogen was teaching in English. So that's kind of, then you feel comfortable. This is a comfortable English and then it flows well and it sort of carries the meaning kind of fairly well and then it's poetic and, you know, it's beautiful and so forth.
When there's, to me it seems that there is sometimes no parallel cultural or social construct.
Right.
How do you look at it?
I think, you know, I'm kind of, another book is in production. It's called Zen Chants. So it's chanting, I think, over 30 chanting texts, starting with dedication, all Buddhas throughout space and time, And I think this is a prayer. So it needs to be, you know, it shouldn't be just a list of kind of nouns or noun compounds, but there should be a verb. So my translation is all awakened ones throughout space and time, all help those who help others to awaken, great beings, together may we realize wisdom beyond wisdom. So may we, you know, realize. In Chinese, you don't have it, but it's implied. So I think in a way, to make kind of, to carry the meaning and then it makes sense, maybe in English, you may have to kind of add some words or take away something, like maybe meal chant, one, first, second, third, and so forth. Maybe we can take out numbers. Maybe, you know, it's what is kind of best for chanting or, you know, for our life. Four vowels were created by GE in China. So he was a founder of Tiantai school, so 8th century or so. So we are not living in the ancient China. So we have different needs, you know, or different understandings. I think adaptation is important. Translation, you can say, okay, this is the original, this is translation, fairly kind of correspond. But sometimes I think translation is limited. For example, the second of the four parts, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Can we end them? Well, sometimes desires are inexhaustible. I vow to cut it off. Can we cut off our desire? Is it good to cut off our desire? And I think I like John Halifax's translation. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. I think it's more psychological, it's more contemporary, you know. And this is not a translation, but adaptation. So, you know, translators have to be clear. This is a translation, this is my adaptation, and so forth. So in terms of the Heart Sutra, I feel this is a kind of radical and kind of wild, but but the translation, you know, can be justifiable, almost. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've been looking for Chinese characters that reflect a translation of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done that in English.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the Bible, gone beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Is it out of reverence that I cannot have there been actual translations? It seems that it's all transliteration of the Sanskrit as opposed to a translation of the mantra. And I understand that the power of the mantra is somehow diminished by translating it, but could you speak to that?
Yeah, mantra is a kind of, maybe the sound itself is a power. And we don't usually translate, I didn't translate, but the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh, and many people kind of explain it, interpret it. And of course it's, in a way, it's important that we know what we are chanting, the meaning. But I think gong gong is suited for funerals. But you know, we chant this for wedding and so forth. Maybe we shouldn't, you know, chant gong gong, you know, during wedding. Maybe we should skip the last part. But Sanskrit, nowadays I think we can really can reconstruct the original meanings of the mantra. And I studied this and then realized that, you know, this gati is a form of gum. The Sanskrit word gum is related to the English word kam, German word kommen, and then also it's related to the English word go. So it's kind of interesting. And then if we gati as a form of or if we see gate as a form of gati, gat means coming or you know, arriving. So I was kind of interpreted it as arriving altogether, arriving all the way, enlightenment, joy. And I think, you know, it's kind of, as a student of Dogen, I think, you know, every moment is in a way an experience of, every moment of practice is an experience of aspiration, practice, enlightenment and nirvana. Nirvana is a non-dual experience. In a way, it makes more sense, I think. Svaha. Joy, blessing, ecstasy. Thank you so much.
Buddha's way is unsurpassable.